Good day, and welcome to the ACS Supreme Court Review Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Caroline Fredrickson, President of American Constitution Society. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. This is Caroline, and I'm very pleased to be here with you today and have an incredible lineup of speakers to discuss these very consequential cases that came down today. ACS, for those of you who are not aware of us, is an organization of progressive lawyers, judges, law students, and others devoted to ensuring that the law is a force to better the lives of all people. So as often happens, the Supreme Court leaves to the very last day its most contentious decisions and then runs out of town as quickly as possible. And that seems like what's happened this year with the decisions in Burwell versus Hobby Lobby, which deals with for-profit companies' challenges to the Affordable Care Act's policy on contraceptive coverage, and the outcome in Harris v. Quinn, which involved a First Amendment challenge to union representation of home care workers. So we're going to start with Hobby Lobby, and we have the privilege today of hearing from Walter Dellinger, who is a partner at O'Melveny & Myers and a former U.S. Solicitor General, a member of ACS's Board of Advisors, and an all-around brilliant analyst of legal developments, and has been very, very involved in the Hobby Lobby case. He filed an amicus brief in the case arguing in favor of the Affordable Care Act's contraception policy coverage. And that brief was filed on behalf of the Guttmacher Institute and co-authored with ACS board member Don Johnson. So, Walter,
yes.
Looking at a piece by Adam Liptak, which came out before oral argument, which suggested that Hobby Lobby is a case putting religious liberty against women's rights. Is that a proper way to frame it, and do you think there was a winner today?
Well, I would hate to declare winners and losers, though I think the decision does marginalize women's access to contraceptive coverage and marginalizes families' access to contraceptive coverage. The court does not, you know, actually necessarily agree that providing contraceptive coverage is a compelling governmental interest, even though, as the brief from the Guttmacher Institute pointed out, having access without fees to contraception as part of health insurance is vitally important because it affects the methods of contraception. That one-third of women would change their method of contraception were cost not a factor. And that is why it has been contraception was determined as part of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act to be a vital part of preventive health services, one to which women or male employees and their families were entitled by virtue of the work they did as part of the benefits they earned and as part of the general preventive health coverage that is so important a part of modern health insurance. That the most effective methods of contraception, like implants and IUDs, can cause...
Well, sir, you're fading out. I'm afraid people are not able to hear you.
I'm sorry. The most effective methods of contraception, IUDs and implants, can cost $1,000, which is a full month's salary for a full-time minimum wage worker. So it's... And these methods of contraception are far more effective than other less costly methods. So there's a vital interest at stake here. The particular holding is narrow because the court suggests that there is a different way for the government to provide that women have contraceptive coverage, and that is by extending the accommodation that the government has made for religious institutions like Notre Dame to extend that accommodation to companies like Hobby Lobby and to allow their insurance companies to provide for the contraceptive coverage. But the critical part about this is that the court does not actually resolve whether or not that accommodation would also violate the Religious Freedom Restoration Act for companies that object that even having their insurance company provide the coverage would somehow make them complicit in the women's decision to have contraceptive coverage. I'll make one last point to reflect what Caroline opened with. You have to remember that many women choose contraception because they have religious reasons for doing so. They may have religious beliefs that the use of contraception is important as part of the obligation to their families, and some may think it important because they want they have very severe reasons for avoiding health care, some because they have concerns about abortion and wish to have the most effective means of birth control. So it is the religious interest of these employees that is subordinated by these legal challenges to the religious interest of the employers. And I'll stop with that.
Well, thanks, Walter. We want to bring into the conversation Caroline Malik Corbin, who is a professor of law at the University of Miami School of Law and had authored an issue brief for ACS, which I commend to you, called Corporate Religious Liberty, Why Corporations Are Not Entitled to Religious Exemptions. Caroline, can you talk a little bit about what you see the implications are of the Hobby Lobby case? Are they bigger than what Walter might have suggested, or was it fairly narrowly drawn? Give us a sense of where you think this is going to take us.
Well, one of the questions before the court was whether for-profit corporations can even bring religious claims under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And the court answered yes. They argue that owners should not forfeit their religious rights just because they decide to incorporate rather than operate as a partnership, for example. And unfortunately, what this means is corporate owners can now kind of have their cake and eat it too. Right? They can be considered one and the same as their company when it comes to religious rights, but separate and distinct when it comes to financial liability, because, of course, the point of incorporation is to take advantage of limited liability. So the first sort of major change is that for-profit corporations, or rather the owners, can still bring claims even in the form of a for-profit corporation. Another major question was whether providing insurance that covered contraception that their employees might or might not use would impose a substantial burden on the corporate owners. And there are lots of reasons to think why the link between the owners and people's independent choice to use contraception is simply too attenuated to be considered a substantial burden on their religious practice. And the court really seems to almost drop out the requirement that the religious burden has to be substantial. In the opinion, they talk about how the court has to evaluate whether the beliefs are sincere or not, but they don't seem to think that substantial has any independent legal force when deciding whether or not a religious burden should be legally cognizable. So that's another problem. And then, of course, there's the question of whether there are alternate means of accomplishing the government's goals. Walter talked a lot about whether there was a compelling interest here or not, and the government and the court actually didn't decide that. But it did say, even assuming that promoting women's health is a compelling state interest, the alternate means can simply be the government providing it itself, which is not an argument that's ever been accepted before. So, for example, imagine an employer who doesn't want to provide cancer screenings for members of a racial minority, right? And it's not likely the court would say, well, there are alternate means than the employer providing those screenings. The government can just do it itself. Or the examples that Justice Ginsburg used in her dissent, well, what if the company is religiously opposed to vaccinations or paying women the same as men? Does it mean that the alternate means is the government can just provide all the vaccinations or the government can make up the pay differential? So all the three major questions before the court, can a for-profit corporation bring a claim? They answered yes. Does a attenuated religious burden count as a substantial religious burden? The court answered yes. And is government providing something itself an acceptable alternative means such that strict scrutiny is not satisfied? The court answered yes. And all these decisions can appear again in future cases.
So I want to ask both of you a question before we turn to the Harris case and then go to questions. But it seems like, in the formulation under RFRA, certainly based on what Professor Corbett has said, in the balance of values, the court's put its thumb on the religious liberty side and against the side that values the opportunity for women to have this service. Is that surprising to you? Is that been traditional in RFRA cases? Is this a big change of in approach?
Well, I think one major development in this case is that the court allows a claim of an indirect religious burden to prevail, even though what happens is a transfer of the burden to a third party. In this case, the women employees who are denied the contraceptive coverage that is a part of the benefit they earn through their employment. Generally, the court has not allowed one person to get a religious exemption from a general law and transfer the burden caused by that exemption onto other individuals. So I think that is a change in this case that tips the scales against those who have a different religious view than their employers.
I absolutely agree. I think and there's actually precedent in the pre-exercise context that explicitly holds that you cannot grant exemptions that impose, if you're a commercial actor, and the exemption would impose burdens on your employees. So this is a very much a departure in religion clause jurisprudence, this willingness to allow a commercial actor to impose a burden on their employees.
It's important to know, I agree with that, and it's important to note that we're not simply talking about mom and pop stores here. Hobby Lobby has 13,000 employees who will be affected by this decision, and the court holds that the court, assuming but not deciding that there might be a compelling interest in contraceptive coverage, holds out the possibility that there is an alternative way for women to be provided contraceptive coverage, but it expressly says we're not holding that that alternative is constitutionally valid either. So for companies that object both to having contraceptive coverage in their insurance and also object to providing notification that would trigger contraceptive coverage independently by the insurance company, there is no guarantee that those women will have contraceptive coverage as part of their employment-based compensation.
So, it's quite interesting. It's what both of you are suggesting is that there are a lot of lawsuits to come, and it seems that there could certainly be something on this issue of the outside insurance company, because I believe that's the issue that has come up with some of the cases, the case involving the nuns. Can you talk a little bit about where you see that going and how quickly that might hit the court?
Well, that the Notre Dame petition is going to be before the court in October. And if they grant it, we don't know. And that will challenge an accommodation by which a religious institution like a church-based university would provide notification that it had an objection to having contraceptive coverage, and that would trigger a requirement on the insurance company for independent provision of contraceptive coverage. The court may well take that case, and there's no way of knowing how that's going to come out. So there's no way of knowing that there is by no means any assurance that women who work for companies where the managers or owners have religious objections will in fact have contraceptive coverage.
So before we turn to Harris, I want to just see if you have any other comments you want to make about the case before we go to Harris and then have questions.
I don't think so, there are at least five justices, counting Justice Kennedy, that accept that that is counting Justice Kennedy and Kagan, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Breyer, who suggest that there is a compelling governmental interest in women having access to contraceptive coverage, but no guarantee that in the face of religious objections they will be able to obtain that coverage.
I just want to add that I think it's really a shame that for-profit corporations are now entitled to religious exemptions, because it's only going to exacerbate the huge power imbalance between employers and employees. And it's especially problematic because corporations are essentially the gatekeeper to health care for so many millions of Americans.
And I'll say one more thing. I think we're entering a period where there will be a continuation of attacks on the availability of contraception by people who object to other individuals' use of birth control.
Well, you know, I think it's very interesting as well, just not to point out the obvious, but the composition of the court does kind of almost become a men against women, or maybe just a fact of ignorance on the part of some justices about the relative importance of something like contraception in the lives of women, particularly women workers. And that brings us to Harris v. Quinn, which I would like to tee up in part as a case about women, because the affected workers are disproportionately women, probably 95% women, and public employee union members are skew female as well. And I think, you know, that puts an interesting slant on the case. But we're going to be speaking with Professor Charlotte Garden, who's a professor of law at Seattle University School of Law and has written for ACS on our blog. She's also our co-faculty advisor of our student chapter there. So we've seen a lot of prognostications about Harris v. Quinn could be the end of public sector unions as we know it. This has been a very important means both to provide public employees with fair pay and benefits, but in particular in the case of the home care workers we're talking about, to enable them to even have a basic, very basic living wage, as well as to guarantee some quality of care for their patients. So what does this case do to that, what I seemed to many to be a very novel and very commendable way of providing somewhat better living circumstances for the workers, but also making sure that the patients were well tended to? So, Professor Garden, I ask you, is Harris the calamity that we see? What does it really set forward? If you could give us a little bit about the shape of the case and then talk about your thoughts about its implications more broadly.
Great. Let me give a little bit of background and then discuss a few takeaways, and especially I want to come back to the important point you just made about the vulnerable workers who are at issue in this case. So Harris involved an Illinois law that allowed certain Medicaid-funded home health care workers to elect a union that would then bargain with the state of Illinois just on those terms and conditions of employment that the state itself set. And it also allowed the union to negotiate a requirement that represented workers pay what's called a fair share fee, and that covers the costs of union representation, so bargaining, grievance administration, but not ideological speech or union political campaigning, things like that. And that type of arrangement has traditionally been allowed in the public sector. That was set in a case called Abood that's been discussed quite a bit. It was decided in 1977. So today the court held 5-4 that these Illinois home health care workers funded by Medicaid can't be required to pay that fair share fee. So another way of phrasing that is that it implements right to work for just those workers, those Illinois home health care workers. So that means that although the elected union must fairly represent all the workers in the bargaining unit, workers can choose not to pay anything for the cost of the representation. So Harris will directly affect more than 20,000 union-represented home health care workers in Illinois. Those are workers for whom the union has negotiated significant improvements in wages. So, for example, in 2003, they earned about $7 an hour. They'll earn $13 an hour by the end of the year. There are also improvements in benefits and training designed to ensure workforce continuity. This is a fast-growing sector of the workforce, and there aren't enough qualified home health care workers. So making these jobs better jobs by raising pay, improving benefits, providing training helps to make sure that we have the supply of home health care workers that we're going to need. The decision, though, was much narrower than the petitioners who were represented by the National Right to Work Legal Defense Fund had asked. The petitioners asked the court to first, in their briefs, hold that the exclusive representation system was unconstitutional in the public sector, or alternatively, that no public sector worker could be required to pay for the cost of union representation. If the court had gone that route, it would have overruled fair share statutes in something like 20 states. Instead, the court held that Illinois home care workers are not true public sector employees, and it really canvassed the details of the Illinois law issue to reach that conclusion. It focused on the fact that the state shares authority with healthcare consumers in that consumers hire and oversee workers on a daily basis. Workers didn't get some state rights and benefits under state law that other public sector workers received. So the other thing that's notable about the decision is that it contains lots of dicta criticizing Abood and other decisions that allow the fair share fee. But for now, that's just dicta. Of course, there's a question about whether the court will extend that dicta in another case, but so far that hasn't happened. So I guess I've got about four takeaways. First, it's an open question how this law will apply in other states that allow employees similar to the home health care workers in this case to bargain via an elected union. Second, I think there's certainly going to be more litigation, both about how Harris will apply in other states and about the continuing viability of Abood as well as the procedural protections that dissenters receive. Third, that Alito described a kind of broad definition of what qualifies as speech as a matter of public concern. And there's some question about whether this could constitutionalize other aspects of how states manage their workforces. That's a change because the court has typically allowed states tremendous leeway to manage their workforces as they see fit, and that's traditionally included by bargaining with elected unions to represent their workers. And then finally, I've seen some sort of predictions that workers will resign en masse from their unions, and I don't think that is necessarily the case. I do think it's the case that unions will have to sort of make the case for why workers should not free ride, right, why they should pay for the cost of representation. And I think there's a compelling case to be made there. As you might imagine, if just one worker decides, well, I'm not going to pay, I'm going to free ride, then that won't make a tremendous difference in the quality of the representation that the union provides. But if all the workers decide, well, I'm not going to pay, then the union won't have enough resources to robustly represent the members. And that's just a matter of sort of traditional union organizing.
So, Professor Garten, you bring up a number of interesting points. I want to ask you first, about the constitutionalization of sort of the discussion about worker pay and benefits in public employment. Do you see that being a broad carve out going forward, or was there any sense that it would be a narrow set of those topics, or any time workers want are agitating in some way to be treated better because they're public employees, all of a sudden there's a free speech issue involved every time they seek to fairer wages or better benefits?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it came up at oral argument. At oral argument, Justice Scalia asked a number of questions on that very issue, and the petitioner's lawyer said that, no, he didn't think that internal discussion of pay and benefits raised a constitutional issue. So I was surprised to see the treatment that that issue received in the majority opinion. I think it remains to be seen whether that will be a wedge that public employees can use to argue that they have more free speech rights at work than they have in recent years, especially under decisions like Garcetti that have said that public employees' speech in the course of their employment receives no First Amendment protection. But I see some tension there, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out in future cases.
So that's sort of the silver lining of the free speech side. So one last question for you. Do you anticipate the sort of situation that happened, I think many of us saw it, with the Shelby County case, where the case that had come right before that, the Nemundo case, Justice Ginsburg described it, sort of laid a, you know, the majority put a bomb in there that eventually went off in Shelby County, sort of a slow ticking bomb that would bring down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. Do you see the suggestions about a boot as being that kind of slow ticking bomb?
I think that's a possibility. Those same types of statements were present in another opinion by Justice Alito in Knox v. SEIU Local 1000 that the court decided 2 years ago. So now we've got two decisions, both Justice Alito, both heavily criticizing Abood. I think that language will certainly invite more litigation about the continuing viability of Abood. I think we should expect to see that issue raised in both existing litigation and new cases next year. And it's certainly possible that that the court will build a five-justice majority in the future. For now, at least, I think there are some, for example, Justice Scalia in a 1991 case articulated a sort of traditional understanding of the reasons for Abood. And so I don't know whether he will have kind of changed his mind about the reasons for allowing the fair share fee in the public sector, or allowing states to choose to allow unions to bargain a fair share fee in the public sector.
Well, I know that we have a number of reporters on the line, so I want to make sure that we don't lose them and that they have an opportunity to ask you all questions. So we're going to open it up now, or operator, for our three speakers to answer questions about Hobby Lobby and about the Harris case.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. And we'll take our first question from Jeff Overly from Law 360.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for doing the call. This is kind of an open-ended question, but I'm just curious if one of you could talk about the implications here for the public perception of the court's stance on women's rights. Previously, from the same five male justice majority, we had the Ledbetter decision, which Congress overturned. And now we're talking about a birth control regulation that had very strong support in the public among women. And so I'm just wondering, to the extent that some people start to view the Roberts Court as basically five men who might be a little indifferent to women's rights, how might that impact the court or public policy going forward?
Professor Corbin, maybe you want to start?
I think there is definitely something to the claim that the majority is indifferent to the needs and rights of women. I'm not sure how that would change anything going forward unless it somehow really motivates people to vote in the upcoming elections.
Okay. And I'm sorry, was that Caroline?
Yes, Caroline Mother Corbin. Because the justices are appointed for life.
Okay. All right. Thank you. If anyone else wants to weigh in, please do. Otherwise, thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Kimberly Robinson from Bloomberg.
Hi. Justice Ginsburg says in her dissenting opinion that the majority's reasoning says it's limited to closely held corporations, but it can be extended really to all for-profit companies. And I'm wondering if you agree with that or if you see some limits in the majority's opinion.
The first thing to note that even the limitation to closely held profits doesn't do very much, since I believe about 90% of corporations are closely held for profits. And I didn't see anything in the court's language that limited the holding to closely held for-profit corporations. Indeed, there was a comment how they thought it wasn't likely that publicly held companies would bring claims, but it did not hold that publicly held companies could not bring claims.
Walter, did you have anything to add? No. Well, this is Caroline. I was just going to say I think Professor Corbin's point is very interesting, because if you have 90% of corporations are closely held, you have to think about what the percentage of the workforce is that actually is in such workplaces. It's got to be, enormously high, even if the public corporations have a very large workforce as well. But I don't know that number off the top of my head, and perhaps Walter does. But
it is important to note that closely held corporations are not necessarily small companies.
Right. Exactly. Hobby Lobby is not small by any means.
Right. Right, exactly. So when people tend to think of closely held, they're thinking of, as you said before, the mom and pop.
Are not mom and pop companies. These are companies with thousands and thousands of employees.
I believe Walmart is a closely held corporation, so that maybe puts it in perspective. And I would ask you before we turn to any other reporters, Walter and Caroline, can you tease out a little bit more what you see the implications are for the conflict between employee rights and religious liberties with LGBT issues or vaccinations? How broad do you think that could be read? What are the issues that might come up in litigation?
Well, I think the potential breadth of the case is significant because in an employment capacity, it is no longer expected that you have to comply with the laws that govern all your competitors and everyone else in the industry, and the court assumes that you may transfer the burden of your religious objections to your employees and doesn't offer any reason why those religious objections should be limited to contraception.
Absolutely. It could be read very broadly. Now, there's a hope that it might not be, and perhaps I'm just clutching at straws here, but to mention that this doesn't necessarily allow corporations to have religious objections involving illegal discrimination, it may be that they had in mind future protections based on sexual orientation. But then again, one could argue that this case itself involved sex discrimination, and yet that did not seem to matter.
Well, I encourage any reporters to get in the queue if you want to ask a question, but I'm going to ask another follow-up in the meantime. And this is for all of you. We had the buffer zone case last week. It's sort of an interesting combination of choice issues and free speech. Do you see between these cases any sort of any roadmap on the First Amendment jurisprudence of the Roberts Court? Is there any coherence to the Harris case and the buffer zone case, or is it is there no discernible understanding of what the First Amendment jurisprudence is there?
The only thing I could say at this point is that if you're on the side of women's reproductive health, you lose.
Seems to be the decisive factor. I don't know, Rod, Walter, if you have
right,
any
well,
thoughts.
Well, there are three cases where religious concerns are expressed, and I think in a dramatic shift that came about with the replacement of Justice O'Connor with Justice Alito, it is now the case that religious positions have a very strong chance of prevailing in the court, as they did in all three cases in which religious issues were involved. In the town of Greece case, those who favored religion were allowed to begin town council meetings with prayers directed at people who were sectarian prayers directed at people who were there to transact business before the government. In McCullen versus Coakley, the court held that religious objectors to abortions had a right to congregate in front of the entrances of reproductive health clinics, and in today's decision, it sustained the right of religious objectors to deny a benefit that women would otherwise have earned through their employment.
So just as a sort of refresher for me and perhaps others on the call, what's the status of the buffer zone or the around the Supreme Court again? Didn't they maintain their right to have a buffer zone?
I'm sure that buffer zone will always stand.
My mother asked me this question, and I thought that was a very interesting way to frame it. So we are going to see if there are any reporters that have any questions, and if not, I want to thank you all so much for talking about these cases and giving us your understanding of what they mean for the jurisprudence of the Roberts Court and cases to come. So, operator, I think unless you have anyone else in the queue, we are we're going to be ending the call.
We have no further questions at this time.
Well, I just want to thank you, all of you, very, very much, and we so appreciate your giving us your time and your views, and we will talk again soon, I think.
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.